We're back with World Crisis Radio. This is Webster Tarpley. I'm so happy to be joined today by a wonderful whistleblower, eyewitness to some of the most important and significant events of recent decades in the shadow world. That is David Shaler. The book is Spies, Lies, and Whistleblowers, MI5, MI6, and the Shaler Affair. I want to remind people you can call in now to 800-313-9443 anywhere in North America, 800-313-9443 with questions for David Shaler. David, you're going to continue to tell me about the Shaler Affair. If people are interested and want to get your book, though, how can they get it?
The best you can do is go to Amazon.com, basically. It's on there.
Okay, perfect. So we were back there with you. You were dealing with somebody who was not 007, but he was PT-16B, and he was dealing with Al-Qaeda.
No, he was dealing with Libya, actually. That was the point. But the plotters were from Al-Qaeda. Essentially, after I came out and blew the whistle, some French journalists and a guy who worked for French intelligence, a guy called Charles Dasquier, came out and said that French intelligence basically knew that these people were actually associates of Osama bin Laden, basically. So they were actually kind of Al-Qaeda in Libya. There can be no doubt about that. And the curious thing about this attack as well, of course, was that by this time, 1996, Al-Qaeda were known to be a threat to the intelligence services, MI5 had set up a section to deal with them. And, of course, Gaddafi had ceased to be a threat. By that time, he'd renounced terrorism and he had no WMD program or anything like that. So there was no reason to do this plot other than MI6 to have power, of course, because MI6 would either have its puppets in place in Libya, as the CIA had a bit with the Taliban and so on, or it would actually then turn around to the world community and say, well, look, we've got Al-Qaeda in charge of Libya, we can't have that, we have to go and invade. And you would have seen what subsequently did happen, of course, in places like Afghanistan and Iraq, happening in Libya earlier, if this operation had succeeded and they'd taken power, basically.
And I would like to pause with that because I think this is one of the really important points that comes out of this book and out of your experience. You have referred to this as 9/11 before 9/11.
Absolutely, yes. This was the association with Al-Qaeda. And say it was done an enormous risk. They hadn't really built up a relationship with this agent Tunworth either. And the thing about this plot as well, I've got to say, is the British government denied it. This gives you astonishing insight into what happens when you do blow the whistle on something like this. Because I used a legal route to alert the British government, and without having an inquiry, the Foreign Secretary said it was pure fantasy.
Take it step by step if we can. How did you then decide to blow the whistle? How did you first blow the whistle, and what was the response?
Well, I actually left the services in October 1996, and I actually went on to have another job. I have to admit that before I went, I did actually copy some documents to prove what I was saying, essentially, in certain cases, not with regard to this particular operation, but other documents. But it took me some time, and I contacted the newspaper shortly after that because I wanted to actually make sure that I could blow the whistle. But I also wanted to get a bit of security, as it were, because what I kept thinking was that I knew about this plot, and I'd left the services, so I was no longer under control. MI6 had also tried to kind of recruit me when I left MI5, in fact. I was told by one of my colleagues, who I strongly suspect was MI6 working in MI5, which you wouldn't believe happens, but does. Told me to go and see MI6 and they would get me a job. But, of course, if they got me a job, I would be beholden to them for the rest of my life. So.
And we'll be right back. We'll be right back on World Crisis Radio.
Can you grow your own nutrition on a shelf indoors in 10 days? Wheatgrass juice is live superfood, the richest nutritional liquid known to man, packed with amino acids, living enzymes, and over 100 elements. 2 ounces of juice have the same nutrition as 3 pounds of choice garden produce. Call 1-877-699-4328. That's 1-877-MY-WHEAT. The stamina, healing, blood building, weight control, and cleansing are just the beginnings of what you will reap from pennies worth of grain. For the book, seed, and the beautiful stainless steel hand crank wheatgrass juicer for $150 plus shipping. No monthly pills, no monthly bills. This is real self-sufficiency. Go to AustinWheatgrass.com or call toll-free 1-877-MY-WHEAT. That's 1-877-699-4328. And thank you for your support of our labors and of the RBN Network.
Would you like to have an income regardless of the economic situation, which few trade people have considered? The art of knife sharpening is a skill that will never disappear and will always be in demand. Whether you have a place of business and just want to add to your income, or would like to travel servicing restaurants, barbershops, or a variety of businesses in need of sharpening tools, you're always guaranteed an income with repetitive business. Learn how to become a successful grindsman. It's easy to learn with our portable Grambo sharpening system. Travel anywhere you desire. Purchase the training manual for only $30, and it'll be applied toward your purchase of the Grambo sharpening system. America has become a service-oriented rather than a manufacturing or even high-tech economy. Take advantage of the situation and become a professional grindsman. It's easy to learn. Start on a shoestring with the overwhelming amount of business out there. Now is the best time to start. Call today for more information. You can enjoy the good life. Call now, 512-297-3152. That's 512-297-3152.
This is Robbie Noel for Republic Trading Group. I want to invite you to visit our new and improved website at republictradinggroup.com, or simply click on the banner at rbnlive.com. Getting timely information on critical financial and political news has never been more important. By starting your day with a visit to the site, it will preserve that promise we make to liberty about being ever vigilant. Speaking of which, those who were vigilant about gold and silver this time last year were well rewarded. We also invite you to sign up to our free weekly newsletter and receive special offers from Republic Trading Group. And for those of you who don't have internet access, just give Republic Trading Group a call and speak to either Jeff Bennett or myself, and we'll be happy to arrange the snail mail alternative. Once again, that number to call is 1-800-691-7898.
We're back on World Crisis Radio here on RBNLive.com, broadcasting via shortwave, an antenna in Tennessee, which is pointed west towards Texas and California and reaches Australia. And our guest today is David Shaler, protagonist of a fascinating book, Spies, Lies, and Whistleblowers, MI5, MI6, and the Shaler Affair. That's available at Amazon.com. It is a fascinating study. I highly recommend it. MI5, MI6, these are superpowers of the intelligence world. MI6 in particular is the oldest one functioning today. They have networks going back centuries. Other intelligence agencies can dream of some of these capabilities, but this is a window into it. David, you were saying that when you went public with the story of MI6, intervening in Libya with assistance from a kind of Al-Qaeda subcontractor, MI6 came to try to recruit you.
No, this was before. This is when I left the services, basically. I announced that I was leaving. I resigned in disgust and found another job. But before I left, MI6 put someone in front of me from MI5 who I knew, but I kind of suspected he had some sort of link with MI6 because he was not a normal MI5 officer by any means, because the two services have a very different profile of officers, basically. So I kind of turned that down. I just didn't want to get involved in it. I just wanted to get out of the intelligence world. But once I'd done that, of course, I became slightly scared that I could just be done away with, because I was the only person outside the services who knew about this plot. And, of course, this would be very big stuff. MI6, plotting the death, the assassination of a foreign head of state and trying to put its own puppet rulers in. This is a violation of international law. It's a violation of all ethics and everything else, basically. And especially the fact they were taking enormous risk giving money to our terrorist enemies, basically. But when I did come to blow the whistle, so the problem was I actually first blew the whistle in August 1997, but the newspaper actually chickened out of running the story, would you believe? There were a lot of other stories which weren't anywhere near as important. And unfortunately, a week after we went on the record, Princess Diana was killed. And that then knocked us out the headlines. So we struggled after that. But then on the 31st of July 1998, we submitted the story to the government with the help of the newspaper.
The newspaper began?
At this point... Sorry, could you say that at this point the government actually had me thrown in prison in France with a view to extradition? So I was, so of course the newspaper I'd given the story to talk to the government was banned from running it. The Sunday Times I'd also given it to managed to squeeze some of it out. But what actually happened in the end was the New York Times ran it, and of course once it was in the public domain, the British newspapers could run with it. It also aired in a BBC programme, BBC Panorama, which is a very prestigious investigative news programme in Britain, stood up key parts of this plot. And the journalist did the story, took this to Robin Cook, who was the Foreign Secretary, and of course, this man had said it was pure fantasy. He took the investigation of Robin Cook, and Robin Cook just declined even to take possession of this evidence, basically. And then, of course, after all these denials and everything else and a refusal to have an inquiry, a document appeared on the internet confirming that an MI6 agent was actually involved in this plot, not reporting on it, involved in this plot, that he was leading a group of Islamic terrorists and that they were asking for support from Her Majesty's government, basically. And also, of course, it predated the plot, so it showed prior knowledge. So this whole plot is a matter of public record now, but if you phone up the British Foreign Office, they will actually tell you that it's still pure fantasy. I mean, this is the kind of world that the state lives in.
Just for the benefit of our listeners, is that document available on the internet still today?
It is indeed, yes. It's quite funny, because once it went up, the site got very quickly attacked, basically, but by that point it had already been mirrored. So it's available on cryptome.org. That's cryptome.org.
Fascinating. Fascinating. We have a question now from Peter in Canada for David Shaler. Peter, are you there?
Yes, Webster, I am. Thank you.
Where in Canada? Canada's about half the world. Where are you?
Montreal.
Okay. Please go ahead.
I wanted to ask, I've heard David interviewed before, and I know where he stands on 9/11. I wanted to ask you, being in the intelligence, or former intelligence, when you try to speak to someone who is a non-believer or who basically buys the government version, and you try to convince them of it being an inside job, and then the most common question that I get that I haven't had an effective response to is, well, if there are treasonous elements within the intelligence community who pulled it off, then where are those who are actually loyal to the country? Why haven't they come out in numbers and gone public to expose the treason?
The problem with that is I think everybody looks at the experience in real life of a true whistleblower. And, you know, I was in a very fortunate position. I could blow the whistle because I didn't have a mortgage. I didn't have children. So I could actually very quickly leave this country, go abroad and do what I did. I mean, if you've got kids and responsibilities and so on, it's very difficult for someone to sort of stick their neck out and effectively lose their job and be hounded in the media and lose all sources of income. So I think, I don't think we can take anything from the sort of general silence that has been. And where people have tried to come out, of course, like Sybil Edmonds, they've had injunctions slapped upon them. Or the FBI officer in Chicago, Robert Wright, he, of course, has also been subject to an injunction as well, so as indeed I am, basically. I mean, I've tried my best to do everything I can to get Tony Blair to just take this evidence off me. I've had to watch in frustration as, wars have unfolded and so on. He just simply won't take my evidence. I knew about things like WMD as well, basically. So the answer to your critics are the silence, there's nothing suspicious there. People are frightened. They are very frightened by what is going on. If these people are prepared to kill 3,000 people, as they did that day, they're quite prepared to take out the odd whistleblower.
Mm-hmm. One more question.
Please go ahead. Follow-up.
Last year, the two SAS agents who were caught in Basra staging the terror attacks, and they had to be busted out of the jail.
Yeah.
You mentioned that the MI6 is supposed to go through the Foreign Secretary for certain operations. Who has oversight of the SAS operations?
Ultimately, the kind of British chiefs of staff, basically, the sort of heads of the army, basically. But of course, it's supposed to always be done in conjunction with the government, basically. But of course, it's not. I mean, this is one of the great fictions of our society, is that governments know what goes on in the intelligence services. Now, I think that's true in certain countries, but it's certainly not true in Britain. In Britain, there's no parliamentary oversight of the services, for example. So they are really accountable to nobody. So again, you know, they can operate out of control because the British people let them. And it was interesting, of course, that it was MI6 intelligence that was used across the world to try and persuade everybody to back an invasion of Iraq. And of course, all of that intelligence, not just some of it, but all of it, turned out to be a complete load of rubbish. So they're not doing particularly well. That was the first time they actually made a document public, essentially.
Very interesting. Thank you, Peter. David, in this courageous action that you undertook to blow the whistle on MI6 and Libya and Al-Qaeda and attempt to kill Gaddafi, you ran afoul of what is called the Official Secrets Act. Am I correct?
That's right, yeah.
And what is that?
Well, the Official Secrets Act, there's actually a joke about it in this country that it's not actually there to protect secrets, it's there to protect officials, basically, because it's very, very widely cast. In my particular case, the prosecution had to prove was that I had worked for MI5, I had talked about MI5, not even revealed classified information, just talked about MI5 without that service's permission. So, of course, I already admitted that, so, you know, and then, of course, in the summing up, the judge actually annulled 300 years of English judicial case law and said that the jury had to find me guilty if they found me guilty on the facts. When it's been an established principle of English law, of course, a jury can acquit on the grounds of justice. So I was absolutely stuffed, basically, and so I had to go to prison again as a result of that.
So how much time have you actually spent in jail as retaliation from this corrupt establishment for the fact that you went public with these important facts that the public had a right to know?
It's been 6 months, which it could have been worse, but I mean, it has been 6 months. And the problem was that jail's always been used as a tactic by them. It was actually used to shut me up about the MI6 funding of Al-Qaeda in 1998. And then, of course, this trial happened beginning around about September 2002, which, of course, was all the time of the dodgy dossiers and so on. So they made sure that when all that was coming out, I was actually occupied with a trial at the Old Bailey and then going to prison, basically. So it was more prison with them is more used as a tactic than as an actual kind of punishment. They're obviously very aware that they don't want to try and create a martyr. And if I'd obviously been sent to prison for any length of time, I think that's what would have happened.
I believe at one point you took your disagreements with Tony Blair directly into the field of challenging him for his seat in the House of Commons?
I didn't in the end. I was going to, but I got a campaign together, but somebody called Reg Keyes, who actually lost a son in the Iraq War, was standing against Tony Blair, and I decided he'd probably, you know, I'd let him have a go at it, basically. And he did very well. He got 10% of the vote, which is extraordinary for an independent. And he also was the moment of the election in Britain where he gave a speech condemning Blair basically as a coward for failing to go and visit the war wounded and the relatives of the dead, basically. I mean, this gives you some insight into the kind of people who are leading us in the world at the moment, that they make these decisions, they get things wrong, but they don't even have the kind of the common decency to go and apologize to people whose lives are completely messed up.
Now, you mentioned that there's a different kind of sociological profile in MI5 and MI6, and maybe you could just say a few words about this, because I think our listeners need to get some idea of what kinds of people we find here. Obviously, if you say MI6, if people are well-informed, they think James Bond. So we can enlighten them a little bit on that. We'll be back in just a second here on World Crisis Radio. We're interviewing David Shaler, MI5 whistleblower. The book is Spies, Lies, and Whistleblowers, available at Amazon.com. A tremendous read. Buy it, and read it.
Since 1988, Herbal Healer Academy has been the global supplier of the finest natural medicines. We specialize in keeping you alive and healthy. We provide outstanding products like ECAC, colloidal silver, olive leaf extract, oregano oil, and hundreds of herbals, oils, books, and educational materials. We have homeopathic detox solutions for chemtrails, radiation, MSG, and aspartame poisoning. We also train naturopathic healers via correspondence education. Why wait any longer? Go ahead and do it today. Sign up on the web and receive our new 120-page catalog and a current Herbal Healer newsletter free. Simply log on to herbalhealer.com and check out the online member testimonials and our hundreds of exceptional products. That's herbalhealer.com, your website for safe, effective, natural alternatives and education.
Would you like to have an income regardless of the economic situation, which few trade people have considered? The art of knife sharpening is a skill that will never disappear and will always be in demand. Whether you have a place of business and just want to add to your income, or would like to travel servicing restaurants, barbershops, or a variety of businesses in need of sharpening tools, you're always guaranteed an income with repetitive business. Learn how to become a successful grindsman. It's easy to learn with our portable Grambo sharpening system. Travel anywhere you desire. Purchase the training manual for only $30, and it'll be applied toward your purchase of the Grambo sharpening system. America has become a service-oriented rather than a manufacturing or even high-tech economy. Take advantage of the situation and become a professional grindsman. It's easy to learn. Start on a shoestring with the overwhelming amount of business out there. Now is the best time to start. Call today for more information. You can enjoy the good life. Call now, 512-297-3152. That's 512-297-3152.
Americans already realize our nation is in deep trouble, need special edition hard copy literature to awaken the widest possible spectrum of people to the imminence of our nation's peril. The Artificially Sweetened Times informs people that the artificial sweetener aspartame is a hidden addiction killing people worldwide with a cluster of symptoms we now call Rumsfeld's disease. Find out who's responsible for unleashing this weapon of mass misery on the world and become part of the global movement to eliminate this neurotoxic drug from our food supply. The People's Income Tax Guide cites congressional records, Supreme Court decisions, and newspaper articles at the time to prove conclusively that wages were never intended to be taxed as income. A lot has happened in the world since 9/11. The report of the Citizens Commission on 9/11 disproves the government's explanation of September 11 through a careful analysis of the evidence. The Artificially Sweetened Times, the People's Income Tax Report, and the report of the Citizens Commission on 9/11 are priced for mass distribution. Sample copies are just $3. Call 208-255-2307 or go to idaho-observer.com.
Back with World Crisis Radio. This is Webster Tarpley, streaming worldwide at rbnlive.com. 11.915 megacycles in the 25-meter band shortwave, local low-power FM here in the United States. And David, you were going to tell us about MI5, MI6. What is this as a kind of a social world? What kinds of human types do you come across?
MI6 is very much more grander than MI5. It's usually people from the grander public schools in Britain, which, of course, are the big private schools, and the two universities, Oxford and Cambridge, which are the kind of equivalent of the Ivy League. Those are the kind of people who finish up in MI6. Now, they all think they're James Bond, of course, but they're really not, you know. A lot of their lives is spent doing a lot of very mundane socialising and so on. Their lives aren't that much different, in some cases, from our foreign office diplomats. Now, they do some exciting spying and stuff, but of course the real people who do the exciting stuff and get their hands dirty are the agents that they actually run, not the MI6 officers themselves.
Now, you are from the north of England, and I wanted to mention this because I call it the Yorkshire School of Analysis, to which I guess that's my starting point too. In the course of your revelations, you were attacked for being a Yorkshireman, letting down the side in terms of MI6.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, they actually attacked me. I did actually walk out of prison in my football shirt, my soccer shirt, just to kind of as defiance to them, basically. And I've got to say, it was one of the best things I did to popularize my case. But yeah, I was criticised basically because, I mean, there's another thing in Britain, is a kind of north-south divide. London dominates the south of England, and of course it's where all the government ministries are, it's where the intelligence services are based, it's where all the big companies are based. So everything happens in London, but of course all the wealth in Britain used to be made in the north of England, because that's where all the industry was, basically. So the empire was actually built on the steel created in places like Middlesbrough, Teesside, and so on. So I came to the kind of wrong side of the tracks, if you like. I mean, I know it sounds like some kind of cliche, but that's really what it felt like. And of course, you know, I was actually a result of a new policy of recruitment within MI5. Up until the early 90s, when I was actually recruited, I wouldn't have even got an interview, basically, because I wouldn't have been considered to be sort of, you know, of the right kind of social profile. But as a result of various changing social conditions in the early 1990s, I had to recruit people from a wider background. And ironically, I mean, I just fell into the services. I didn't know. When I first applied to the advert, it didn't actually say what the job was. It just said, do you have an interest in current affairs and analyzing information? Because I was a journalist, I sent off a CV. And in the first interview, they wouldn't actually tell me what the job was. So they said, what have you done to change the world? And I said, when I was an editor of my student newspaper at college, I published extracts of the book Spycatcher, which, of course, at the time was under injunction in Britain.
Right.
And, of course, they said, why did you do that? And I said, because the intelligence services shouldn't be destabilizing our government. And they said, what about national security implications? And I said, well, there aren't any, because obviously if anybody's going to use it for bad, it would have been when the book was first published in America, because we were in the bizarre position in Britain where this book was available abroad but banned in Britain, can you believe? So, of course, at the next interview, this came up again when they said, oh, by the way, we're MI5. And they said, oh, in your first interview, you said you published extracts of Spycatcher. So I thought at that point that I wasn't going to get in. But strangely enough, they did employ me, and ultimately people say to me, why do they employ me? And I say, well, you're going to have to ask them that.
Now, we have some open lines. You can call in and pose a question to David Shaler, MI5 whistleblower and celebrity whistleblower in Great Britain, 800-313-9443. David, we had a meeting on the Jimmy Walter Euro Tour last June, I guess. We were near Russell Square. I think Vanessa Redgrave was chairing it. You stood up and said, I was LIHOP, I am MIHOP on 9/11. Could you fill us in on that?
Yeah, I mean, I was actually, I've got to say, very slow to get to grips with 9/11, because at the time, obviously, I had my own problems with the government, and I was trying to get my own evidence heard, because obviously, the key to this is I'm a witness to all this, so I bring a certain weight, but of course, that's why they don't want to take the actual evidence. But I was approached by people from the 9/11 movement in Britain, and I'd had my doubts, obviously, about 9/11 already, just simply because, you know, the level of planning required to carry out that operation would have been enormous. The idea that the FBI wouldn't pick up anything about this, to me, as a former counter-terrorist officer, was just absolutely absurd. You know, I just couldn't believe that. And I got very suspicious about how those hijacks had been identified so quickly. But these are all sort of just worries in my mind, and I was in that kind of area of thinking, well, this may be incompetence, because I had witnessed a lot of incompetence in the services, of course. Now, I've come to believe that incompetence actually is strategic. The role of these kind of the shadow government is on two levels. One, it's actually manipulating funding terrorism and so on, but it's also, it seems to perform a role in terms of neutralizing our own services so we can defend ourselves less well. So I did think it was incompetence, but then when I obviously started to look at 9/11, it was that became an untenable position. And I've got to say, when you think about it, LIHOP actually doesn't make any sense, because even if the FBI did have intelligence saying these guys were going to fly planes into buildings, you can't just let them go do that, because they might not. They might go and put it down the nuclear power station outside New York. So LIHOP is, in fact, a nonsense. You know, you've either got to say that this wasn't an inside job at all, or it was, basically.
Authoritative testimony from David Shaler on 9/11. We'll be back in just a second.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
Why continue to suffer from pain, illness, and disease when natural health and wellness therapies are within your reach? Hundreds of people report improved health and wellness using Rife Frequency Technology. In the 1920s, research scientist Royal Raymond Rife discovered that disease organisms can be destroyed using resonant frequencies. The BioSolutions frequency instrument uses this same technology for relief or elimination of pain and disease conditions. There are no side effects. Join others in discovering a return to a natural health and wellness. Don't just treat the symptoms, eliminate the cause. BioSolutions has over 550 pre-programmed auto-sequences for various health conditions and is very easy to use. Customer satisfaction is guaranteed or your money back. For more information, call toll-free 1-866-885-6625. That's 1-866-885-6625.
Hi, this is John Statmiller, and I want to tell you about a new shortwave receiver that we're really excited about. It's the Kato KA1103, and let me tell you, this radio has features and performance of receivers costing 2 to 3 times the price. Features include dual conversion phase lock loop tuner for continuous coverage of the entire shortwave band, AM, FM, and medium bands, 268 memory presets, single sideband reception with fine tuning control, signal strength, meter, battery, power indicator, DX local select, tone select, auto backlight screen, extra long telescopic amp, antenna, line out, and external line in jacks, and many other features too long to list. And when you purchase a Kato KA1103, you just don't get a radio, you get an entire radio package, including an external antenna, stereo earbuds, and an AC adapter, rechargeable batteries, and a nice carry pouch. So if you've been considering buying a shortwave receiver or would like to upgrade from your present radio, the KA1103 at just $110 plus $9 shipping is an outstanding value. Call us at 800-724-2719. 800-724-2719.
Most Americans want our government to control our borders, especially since 9/11. But amazingly, some political leaders want to do away with borders entirely, whether the American people agree or not. And they have a serious plan for accomplishing their aims while deceiving the public. It's called the Free Trade Area of the Americas, or FTAA, a huge power grab. If Congress approves the FTAA, our nation will be pushed down the same path that produced the European Union. There will be no more illegal immigration because there will be no enforcement of borders. Americans will lose control of their destiny as regional bureaucrats from corrupt political systems decide our future. Sound incredible? Check out the facts for yourself. Go to stoptheftaa.org. Then tell Congress you want a better future for America. That's stoptheftaa.org.
World Crisis Radio. We are broadcasting here on rbnlive.com, streaming worldwide, 11.915 megacycles in the 25-meter band shortwave. We do have some lines open, 800-313-9443. Questions for David Shaler. Again, the book, Spies, Lies, and Whistleblowers, MI5, MI6, and the Shaler Affair. Buy it at Amazon.com. It is a fascinating and indeed unique window into the world of some of the premier intelligence agencies of the world. Now, David, we have now about a 22-minute segment. We can get a lot done. I guess I would try to pick 3 points out of your book. Maybe we should start with the Irish Republican Army and how MI5 failed to stop several important terror attacks in Britain. And you might want to bring it up to date now to the recent events regarding the IRA, some alleged double agents that now seem to have been assassinated.
That's right. Yeah, well, this is it. Dennis Donaldson, who was actually an informer against Sinn Féin for 20 years, in fact, who actually admitted to this a few months ago, has been murdered in Ireland. And it's quite astonishing that all the coverage in the British press is saying this is the IRA. The IRA, of course, have denied it. Sinn Féin have denied it. And, of course, the IRA don't stand to gain by these things. These things are done to destabilise the peace process. So, to me, it's got all the hallmarks of a killing by the securocrats, basically. You know, those in the shadow government who don't want peace in Northern Ireland, they don't want peace anywhere because how they make their money is through arms sales and so on. And yet nobody in the mainstream media is prepared to entertain this. But what I have to say, yeah, I mean, about the IRA, I mean, this is also something that is astonishing, is how this has happened before. We had someone called Steak Knife, someone called Freddy Scapatacci, who was actually the head of the IRA's interrogation squad, known as the Nutting Squad. So we had a situation in which he was working for the British government and actually torturing and executing other informants who were working for the intelligence services. I mean, can you believe that this has happened? I mean, and this is a matter of public record. This was established by an inquiry carried out by a very senior policeman called John Stevens in Britain. And what we've got at the moment is Tony Blair actually blocking the prosecutions of the military people involved in this, even though we've had recommendations that they should go on trial immediately. And, of course, the worry, I think, of the government is that these people are going to go on trial, of course, and they're going to say, we were just following orders. And, of course, this goes right back to the heart of the Thatcher government in the 1980s, which, of course, is a very right-wing government, very close to the Reagan government, basically. So for that reason, Blair is sitting on the prosecutions, which is a disgrace. But they reckon in all 30 innocent Catholics were murdered by collusion between loyalist terrorists and the British military intelligence and MI5 and MI6 and so on.
I think we've just made some news. If you're saying that the killing of Dennis Donaldson was actually done by, can we be a little bit more specific, a joint British-Irish...
I don't think the Irish should get involved in this. I mean, I think this will be elements of MI6, elements of the special forces in Britain. It seems that they're the ones, I think, who are doing this. So they're the ones who have their mitts all over this kind of thing, basically. Well, I can say, I do not believe this for a second. It's an Irish distant group. I don't believe it's the IRA.
Not the IRA.
Doesn't add up. It just doesn't add up at all. And it was the same with the bank robbery in Northern Ireland. It just looks like people are trying to frame frame the IRA for these things, and they haven't carried them out because they're trying to destabilise the peace process. And, of course, we saw this, of course, with the dossier justifying war, where on the 9th of September 2002, there was no convincing intelligence, so Blair told the services to go out and get some. And, of course, what happened? They went to their friends in the Iraqi dissident movement, who then came back with this kind of 45-minute claim about launching weapons of mass destruction. So, you know, the whole thing about intelligence, it's a dirty game, and it's just all about lying, you know. And I've got to say, we're going to talk about other points from the book, if I could just move away from the IRA for a sec, because...
Sure thing.
What I also found in the services, I was briefed, or I learnt about it, what's known as an information operation, carried out by an MI6 section called IOPS, who actually plant stories, usually made up, in the British media. Now, people suspect this goes on, of course, but I actually read a story in the Sunday Telegraph in Britain, which mentioned the Libyan regime. So from a point of view of my job in MI5, I checked it out with MI6 to see if they knew anything about it. And it transpired that they just simply made this story up about Colonel Gaddafi's son getting involved in money laundering and relations with the Iranian regime behind Gaddafi's back. And, of course, it was all nonsense because Gaddafi used to despair, ironically, about his son not being interested in the regime, you know. And anyway, but this, of course, was published as a story. And normally, of course, that would be that. But what happened in this case was Gaddafi's son sued. But what was really interesting about how this story came out, of course, was that MI6 had this journalist who worked with the Sunday Telegraph, who was essentially an MI6 information agent. He was, you know, MI6, his job was to put out MI6 propaganda. He never checks facts on his stories. He would be spoon-fed by MI6. He didn't even source this story to MI6. He sourced it falsely to a British banking official to actually cut out any idea of MI6 involvement in the story. And, of course, the editor of the Sunday Telegraph at the time was Dominic Lawson, who'd already been exposed as an MI6 agent. And, of course, I knew that as well about him. And so, of course, this story is actually invented by MI6, given to a tame journalist who writes a story, doesn't check any facts. An editor who is also tame then makes sure that this story gets good prominence in a national newspaper. But then, of course, you know, nobody knows this is all completely fabricated. And, of course, then that's in the archive. months later, years later, journalists look this stuff up and think, oh, right, you know, this looks very interesting, because they don't know it's just been invented. So I find myself now, whenever I do read the British press, and I've got to say I'm just about giving up on them because there's nothing of any interest in them anymore. When I do, it's almost like you have to decode the articles. It's almost like the communications coming out of the intelligence services, and they're sometimes attacking the other intelligence services, because although they present a united front in public, what they don't, what, you know, behind the scenes, they are constantly fighting, basically. But anyway, back to the IRA. I digress slightly there. But yeah, one of the concerns I had in the services was just the inability to stop terrorist attacks, because what happened was, if I give you the background for this, is I was actually in a section of MI5 who took over responsibility for the IRA on the British mainland. Up until that point, it had been the responsibility of the police special branch, who were a kind of intelligence, a sort of strange intelligence agency that exists because of Britain's traditions. You know, we never actually sit down and do these things properly. So they just, we'd just taken this responsibility off them. But when they handed over responsibility to us, there wasn't a single reliable, taskable agent reporting on the IRA in the British mainland. That's just extraordinary. You know, this is how poor they were. And I stress that the only way to get prior intelligence is through, you know, good agents, good human agents. And then, of course, they handed over all this information that was out of date. They were actually tapping people's phones on the basis of information that was, in some cases, years old. It was information that had been inaccurately recorded in the warrant and so on. But then you'd think MI5 then would reject all these and get on with the job in hand. But oh, no. They carried on reapplying for these warrants on this out-of-date, inaccurate information, knowing that it was out-of-date and inaccurate. So the whole attempt by, you know, officers like me in MI5 on the ground trying to get this, you know, trying to stop the IRA was being stopped by bureaucrats within the service, which is, you know, has echoes, I think, of what happened prior to 9/11 with the FBI, where you have people looking at all the information thinking, we've got to do this. And people at the centre are just trying to stop you all the time, because this is one of the things they do to create terrorism. If they're not actually funding it, they are in this position of at least allowing organisations like the IRA to carry out attacks, because the IRA, of course, used to give code-worded warnings. So there was never any danger of civilian casualties. Very, very rare there was actually civilian casualties. So from the point of view of the service, it was very good to be able to allow the IRA to do this. And, of course, they did. Between MI5 taking over in October 1992 and April 1993, there were more attacks on the British mainland, a greater frequency than has ever been at any other point, basically. But, of course, eventually MI5 did try and get to grips with this. But one of the things I want to tell you about is a case I was involved in, involving somebody called Sean McNulty, where what happened is he'd gone to see his handlers in the IRA for some tasking. He'd gone to a safe house in Scotland. He'd been photographed there. But unfortunately, the photo had taken 12 days for these photographs from this, you know, the MI5's main operation at the time, to get onto my desk at MI5 HQ in London. Now, I know it's 500
12 miles. Days, 12 days to go how far? How many miles?
To go 500 miles, basically.
500 miles. Amazing.
This, of course, is an era of the infant internet and newspapers plastering pictures over wires and so on. But I actually found out, would you believe, rather comically, that this van used to go and collect the secure material from Scotland and bring it back down again. But it only used to do it once every 2 weeks. So it only got to pick this operation, you know, once a fortnight. And as a result of that, these pictures arrived 12 days late. But, of course, in the meantime, there had been two attacks in the northeast of England on two gas terminals. Now, one of the attacks had been slightly unprofessional and actually nearly completely taken this plant up, basically, which could have killed a lot of people. Fortunately, you know, nobody died. But these were two spectacular attacks, because lighting, you know, you bomb a gas terminal, you get big flames, and it was all over the newspapers and everything. And it transpired, of course, you know, this guy was actually subsequently in a court of law convicted of these attacks. But, of course, if we'd had those pictures beforehand, he would have been under surveillance, he would have been caught in the act, it would have all been simpler, and of course the bombs wouldn't have gone off. But it got worse, though. Even we only just got a prosecution. In Britain, you can have split verdicts of 10-2 with the jury. And the only reason that we got the reason that happened was because the police lost a pair of his trousers that had been forensicated for Semtex, the explosive, basically.
Mm-hmm.
These got lost. And I tried to find out why this had happened, and nobody wanted to tell me, basically. But rather bizarrely, with this, the thing about the 12-day delay, I got fed up of, you know, saying to people in MI5, this is unacceptable, we've got to do something about things like this, we can't allow this to happen again because people are going to die. And nobody would take a blind bit of notice, so what I did was I wrote a brief that was going outside the service, and literally the first addressee of this brief was HMQ, or to other human beings, the Queen of Britain. And the second addressee was the Prime Minister. And I thought, right, this is a great way to tell them what's going on in this service. But, of course, I wrote this brief. And then, of course, I got it copied back to me when it went out of the service. And it had been changed. It had been changed to give the impression that the photographs, or not even give the impression, it stated that the photographs had been taken after the attacks rather than about 11 days beforehand. So this is what they were like. You know, when push came to shove, they would just simply lie to government. And I had a similar experience. I had to prepare an assessment on Libya when I first took over the desk. And I went through all the files on Libya. And the first conclusion I came to in my kind of key points was there is not enough reliable intelligence to come to an informed assessment about Libya, because there simply wasn't. But, of course, this was all played down. They made me redraft the report, taking out this line and all this sort of thing and this report. And would you believe the joke about this report? They sat on it for 18 months. And then before I left the service, I said to somebody, has this gone out? And they said, yes. I left the service. Then one of my friends afterwards told me that, in fact, it hadn't gone out. They still sat on it. They didn't want to go to the government because it just showed how little they knew about Libya. And, of course, this has resonance because of the whole Iraq debacle. Because, you know, if the government had known that they were forming assessments about Libya on the basis of very little reliable information, they might have taken that into account and thinking, well, they're doing the same thing in Iraq, and they might not have made this disastrous mistake of invading, basically.
So I guess it's a combination of a generalized incompetence, which may be spontaneous, that, however, serves to camouflage the strategic incompetence. We have a caller. We have Paula Gloria in New York City, who is, in her own right, a leading cable broadcaster in Manhattan. She's on Manhattan Neighborhood Network. Paula Gloria, your question, please, for David Shaler. Paula Gloria in New York City.
Yes. Have you? Can you hear me okay?
Fire away.
Okay, great. This is the first time I've listened to your radio show, and it's very encouraging that through the Internet, people from all parts of the world can get to know each other. The question I have for David is, how is he being treated when he's in prison for 6 months?
Well, when I was in prison in France, I was actually treated very well, actually, strangely enough. And the prisoners I was in there with were actually used to joke that I was a political prisoner and things like that. And I had a cell to myself, and I was allowed out 6 hours a day and so on. But when I was in prison in Britain, of course, they did the classic thing of all tyrannical regimes and treated somebody who was a political prisoner worse than the common criminal. So I was sent to a maximum security jail. In fact, the same jail, would you believe, where they send these so-called Al-Qaeda people that they're holding in Britain, detaining in Britain without trial or charge at the moment. So that gives you an idea what they thought about me, even though I was quite obviously a white-collar criminal with no previous form at all. And then they made it very difficult. They kept me in this maximum security prison for much longer than you'd normally be kept there. And at the time, I was put in with somebody who'd murdered somebody. I was put in with junkies. They made absolutely no concessions at all. In fact, you know, in some ways, they were almost like they were trying to get me to break, basically. In the same way I was in prison in France, actually, because the French authorities actually...
I thought that was just so funny.
...spy. It was only when the French learnt that I'd actually been writing articles that they very quickly decided that I was actually a political prisoner and I should be let free, basically. And that was the conclusion, of course, of the French court. That's why they didn't extradite me. I was considered political.
Well, where do you want to go from here? In other words,
several of the chemists confirmed that, yes, that was, in fact, a fine, proper synthesis of
people who might be on the verge of coming forth in so many different areas.
Well, would you believe what's happening at the moment is that the...
Drax has never, to our knowledge, been made by man.
It's my whistleblowing now. They put me in prison and kind of ruined my life and, you know, maligned me in the British press. And now, of course, they want to, you know, finally get some kind of civil damages out of me for breach of copyright and breach of confidence.
You need a good lawyer, huh?
Well, I don't trust lawyers in this country, I've got to say. I didn't think my representation was particularly good in Britain. I defended myself in my trial, even though there wasn't a lot of defending
because,
to do.
Because the general at Abu Ghraib, you know, was a woman, and she was demoted, I think, to a colonel and then kicked out. And when she wrote her book, the White House wanted to see it, and so she...
I'm one of those. People who like to...
Those kind of
facts. Yeah.
The problem in Britain is the law is much more draconian in Britain. This is the problem. But what I'm doing at the moment to try and say is that when I go on this court case, what I want to do is use that to publicise what is going on. Because I'll be able to put in court documents, I'll be able to sort of put stuff in about the MI6 funding of Al-Qaeda. I'll say that the injunction against me has been taken out not to protect national security as they claim, but to suppress freedom
of them all. So if you
that you didn't get profiled before you got this job, because you seem like a person of integrity with no mortgage, no children.
Can I take a picture of that? You'll know why that is.
You should be employing people like me who kind of do stand up and say, well, hang on, this is going wrong here, and, you know, we shouldn't be doing this, and we're dying.
But not according to...
We were at an outdoor party a couple of years ago, and it was like 3 a.m. or something like that.
If you're interested in the lady from Abu Ghraib, she has a program coming right up on RBN Live.
Since 1988, Herbal Healer Academy has been the global supplier of the finest natural medicines. We specialize in keeping you alive and healthy. We provide outstanding products like ECAC, colloidal silver,
can we take a picture of the exosuit
solutions for chemtrails, radiation, MSG, and aspartame poisoning. We also train naturopathic healers via correspondence education. Why wait any longer? Go ahead and do it today. Sign up on the web and receive our new 120-page catalog and a current Herbal Healer newsletter free. Simply log on to herbalhealer.com and check out the online member testimonials and our hundreds of exceptional products. That's herbalhealer.com, your website for safe, effective, natural alternatives and education.
Would you like to have an income regardless of the economic situation, which few trade people have considered? The art of knife sharpening is a skill that will never disappear and will always be in demand. Whether you have a place of business and just want to add to your income, or would like to travel servicing restaurants, barbershops, or a variety of businesses in need of sharpening tools, you're always guaranteed an income with repetitive business. Learn how to become a successful grindsman. It's easy to learn with our portable Grambo sharpening system. Travel anywhere you desire. Purchase the training manual for only $30, and it'll be applied towards your purchase of the Grambo sharpening system. America has become a service-oriented rather than a manufacturing or even high-tech economy. Take advantage of the situation and become a professional grindsman. It's easy to learn. Start on a shoestring with the overwhelming amount of business out there. Now is the best time to start. Call today for more information. You can enjoy the good life. Call now, 512-297-3152. That's 512-297-3152.
There is one and only one national populist news weekly, staffed by an unsurpassed team of veteran investigative journalists who have dared to rip the veil of deception from the cover-up stories promoted by the big money-controlled media monopoly. American Free Press. AFP's no-holds-barred journalists fearlessly seek the truth, no matter how controversial the issue. AFP publishes exciting, in-depth, uncensored news and information good patriotic Americans need to know to combat the coming police state being clamped in our republic. The American Free Press is your voice. Subscribe today and catch up on the real news. Mention RBN when you call and receive a one-year subscription, plus a copy of Michael Collins Piper's latest bestseller, The High Priests of War. All that for just $49? Call AFP toll-free, 888-699-NEWS, or visit AmericanFreePress.net.
This is World Crisis Radio. We're back for our final couple of minutes with David Shaler. I've just got a couple of quick questions for you, David. I understand that they're harassing you through the legal system. I want to pledge to you that this program will be available so you can deliver updates on that outside of the range of the Official Secrets Act. Maybe you just give us quick comments, David, on a couple of issues that people might be interested in. From the point of view of MI5, what's the reputation of the Israeli Mossad? How do they look? A lot of people seem to think that they're supermen of the intelligence world. I think you have a differing view.
Well, I think that sort of in some ways they're like anybody else who works in secret, aren't they? They can be utterly ruthless, but they're also utterly incompetent as well, which is a dangerous combination, of course. We found when I was in MI5 that Mossad are actually banned from Britain. In fact, even Margaret Thatcher banned them because they were carrying out illegal intelligence operations in Britain and got caught. But, of course, what they do, and again, I know this from being in the service, is that they send over these known as unavowed officers. But even when I was in the service, one of those was expelled for threatening Palestinian dissidents in Britain. But I don't think, you know, I mean, I think, of course, that they were responsible for the Israeli embassy bombing in London. I think the Israelis bombed their own embassy to get security increased around the building by the British state, basically. And, of course, what they also did in a classic operation was frame two innocent Palestinians who, of course, were very vocal in London in terms of popularising the Palestinians' plight. So it's another classic example where I can say from being in the service that I know that certainly a senior MI5 officer had seen all the information, thought that the Israelis had bombed their own embassy. Now, that wasn't disclosed in the trial of the two people convicted of causing conspiracy to cause explosions.
I believe in one of your speeches you once said that the Mossad have a tendency to cuck it up.
That's absolutely right, yes. Well, what I said was because on the day of that attack on the Israeli embassy, the security camera wasn't working where the thing was driven in, but also, crucially, the three senior diplomats weren't there that day. And you kind of think, well, if you knew that Bob Mossad was supposed to allow for a controlled explosion, you wouldn't want to be anywhere near there, given their reputation for getting these things wrong.
One last thing. How about the death of Princess Diana, very briefly?
Well, the death of Princess Diana, again, I mean, I say from my point of view, it took us out of the news. And I'm not saying they did that just for that, but it was good. The timing was ideal for them. It really was. But what particularly alerted me to this was after someone called Oswald Le Winter, who I'd come across as an MI6 misinformation agent about Lockerbie, would you believe, had actually popped up with some documents that he'd shown to Mohammed Al-Fayed, wanted $20 million for them, saying they were proof of the conspiracy. Now, I looked at these documents and saw they were obvious forgeries. But this is a classic, you know, the classic straw man technique. They wanted Al-Fayed to run around with these documents telling everybody. And then, of course, they would denounce them, and then anything that subsequently came about Princess Diana, of course, would be thought to be false. That's the effect of the straw man technique.
But why did she have to die?
I think a number is, I think she was pregnant. That's why the body was embalmed, so nobody would know. It's quite obvious there's some suspicious stuff going on around Henri Paul, and the witnesses around the Fiat Uno, and the guy, of course, who owned the Fiat Uno, who died in a car. He burnt, apparently, especially committed suicide by burning himself out in a car, would you believe? So that's the kind of thing that happens to people who know too much.
Was it the issue that they didn't want to have the Queen Mother of England be a Muslim?
I think that was the problem. She was going to start campaigning on Palestine, apparently. That was part of the problem. And also the problem, obviously, that if she did have a child, that would be a relation to the British king. I don't know if you're up on things like the Priory of Sion, but I believe that the whole thing about Prince William is trying to get a Stuart king back on the throne.
Okay, well, I'm afraid we've run out of time. David Shaler, Spies, Lies, and Whistleblowers. Buy it on Amazon.com. We'll be back next week with Jim Fetzer of Scholars for 9/11 Truth. Thank you, David, and more power to you. See you next week on RBN Live.
The Bill of Rights protects every American's God-given right to keep and bear arms. Now that right is being seriously undermined as legally registered rifles are being confiscated in some parts of our country. If we're not careful, we may find ourselves with no right to own guns. And that's where Gun Owners of America comes in. Gun Owners of America is in Washington every day fighting for you to keep that right. Congressman Ron Paul has called GOA the only no-compromise gun lobby in Washington. You need to be part of this great grassroots group of activists who are keeping the heat on their members of Congress. Find out right now how you can join. Call 888-886-GUNS and get started receiving their fact-filled newsletters and action alerts. Call 888-886-GUNS or go to their webpage at gunowners.org and help make your voice heard in Washington. Make that call right now and call Gun Owners of America at 888-886-GUNS. Remember, it's not just about gun control, it's about control.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Brazil and Argentina.